Call the Civil Law Committee to order. Members, quorum is present. We do have some members moving between a couple committees as necessary tonight. So, quick housekeeping. House file, Senate file 55 won't be coming up tonight. And so if anybody's here for that purpose, I want to make that announcement, not to keep you here extra long. The intention will probably be to bring that up tomorrow, either at our 12:30 time or recess into the evening meeting. Is there a motion to approve the 4:18:11 minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Holder moves approval of the 4:18:11 minutes. Is there any discussion? Having none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Members, we'll call Representative Kiffmeyer up here. I understand there's some that want to testify on this and opposition. And so what we'll do from the outset here, members, try to get us home before midnight. With four bills, I think it's reasonable to maybe get home for the 10 o'clock news, but if not, the at least the 11 o'clock news. Representative Kiffmeyer, the proponents go for 20 minutes. Those that are here that may have opposition testimony, will you please get together, and you will have 20 minutes. We will divide the minutes among the different parties that want to testify. If you do, why don't you raise your hand? Is there anybody here that's to testify in favor of Representative Kiffmeyer's bill? The family and Representative Severson and Representative Kiffmeyer, former Rep. Severson, I should say, Representative Kiffmeyer, I think you know of all them. Anybody opposed, please raise your hand, and then actually, why don't you send a note up through the page to the front here, so we know who's on the list, and then we can divide you. You know. Okay, John will come and talk to you, so you can organize Representative Kiffmeyer. Representative Kiffmeyer, the chair will move House File 1129 to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Government Operations Committee. Is that what you understand?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. That's what I understand.
Okay. Let me amend it.
And it's 1119.
Representative Kiffmeyer, I misspoke. It's House File 1119. The chair moves House File 1119 be recommended to pass and re-referred to GovOps. Representative Kiffmeyer, welcome to our committee, and your 20 minutes starts now, and I'll let you regulate it yourself. We'll give you a five-minute warning and a one-minute warning.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of Civil Law Committee. I appreciate your time this evening to hear this very important bill. And without a question, the right to vote does have qualifications in it listed in our Minnesota Constitution. And, Mr. Chairman, the voting process and the ability to vote is absolutely important. But I recognize, though, that those who wrote our Constitution also recognize that very much, and we do as well, but they also anticipated that those things that were in the Constitution in regards to the qualifications or the exercise of that right were also meant to be carried into state law as well. Just a brief, I want to have my testifiers have the maximum amount of time. My bill here in regards to Section 1 in particular is aligning itself with the Minnesota Constitution. And in the Constitution, it specifically states in this regard that someone who is under guardianship is not eligible to vote, nor shall be permitted to vote. And that's just a clear reading of what the Constitution says. Section 1 in the refers to the statute here, and the law was changed a few years ago, It had previously been in line with the Constitution, which meant that you did not have the right to vote if you were under guardianship, but the court could order that your right to vote would be restored to you. And that's the way it was for many, many, many years. And not too long ago, it was changed so that the statute conflicts with the Constitution. So what I do in Section 1 and in Section 2 is reinstate the language that fits with the Constitution. So under guardianship, in which a court order has not reinstated the ward's right to vote, and that is in keeping with our Minnesota Constitution. It goes on again in Section 2, Section 3 as well, just consistently bringing that language through in the various places in statute where it occurs. Then, Mr. Chairman, my concern, though, is that there are those, in Section 5 as well, line 617 says, pursuant to the Minnesota Constitution, Article 7, unless otherwise ordered by the court. And so, again, reflecting the Minnesota Constitution. Mr. Chairman, after testimony in another committee, and just in my general concern, to make sure that if someone were under guardianship but did have the capacity to make an independent voting decision, I myself as a guardian of my sister, who has a mental age of 4, right now has the right to vote, according to current Minnesota law, but not according to the Minnesota Constitution. My sister is one that if I took her to the voting place and went through all the registration process, she would have the right to vote. And indeed, if I were with her helping her to mark her ballot, she would mark it in any way that I asked her, but she would not be able to make an independent decision on that vote, nor have the knowledge to cast that vote. But right now, between the Constitution and law, there is that conflict, and the law right now gives her that right to vote. My concern after hearing about a particular situation was, how could I protect her? She's a vulnerable adult, age 52. How can I protect her? I'm her guardian. I'm responsible for that. And I felt that the system and the Constitution understood that it is we, those around those who are in that situation, that need to take a protective stance and make sure that they are not exploited and that they are protected. On the other hand, in Section 6, I also do make allowance in the annual report of the guardian that if, in the view of the guardian and in the court, that the person under guardianship should have that right to vote, does have that ability to make an independent voting decision, the current process in statute is already there for the guardian and for the court to conduct as part of the annual review, and has a great deal of documents as well as to the status of the ward, would be able to restore the right to vote to the person, to the ward under guardianship. Mr. Chairman, I also have here today current Minnesota law on 524.5101, and it talks about the whole protection of persons under disability and their property, general provisions. I thought it was interesting that the guardian on subdivision 5 means a person who is qualified as a guardian of a minor incapacitated person pursuant to appointment by parent, spouse, or by the court. And it goes on in a little bit more detail. But it describes an incapacitated person. It means an individual who, for reasons other than being a minor, is impaired to the extent of lacking sufficient understanding or capacity to make or communicate responsible personal decisions, and who has demonstrated deficits in behavior which evidence an inability to meet personal needs for medical care, nutrition, clothing, shelter, or safety, even with appropriate technological assistance. Mr. Chairman, there are a few people that I believe who maybe are under guardianship, who maybe might be better served by a conservatorship or limited power of attorney, that I believe, on the other hand, are currently under guardianship and I think would be able to have that ability to vote. And so my second part of the bill is enabling a process. I was told when I asked about how could I protect my sister, what would I have to do, because current law gave no process. And they said I should hire an attorney and go to court and all this process. When you realize what the Constitution says and the importance of that, it seemed to me a more fair process to make the statute comply with the Constitution and allow a process where everybody has access, not only during the annual review, but at any time during the year, if the status is such that they are able to make an independent voting decision, that they're able to have the right to vote restored and yet still be under guardianship. Mr. Chairman, that is my bill, and I would also say that I have some testifiers here as well who would speak to the issue, but that is the presentation of the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer. Let's have your testifier proceed and get the testimony, then we'll ask questions after both sides have presented. Mr. Steen?
Yeah, my name is Alan Steen.
Welcome to our committee. You may proceed.
Thank you.
And just remember, you need to be part of the 20 minutes for the proponents.
There's a lot of information on this, and
Make sure the microphone is close to you.
Okay. There were some handouts. Did you get some handouts? The committee get some handouts?
Yes, we did.
Okay. I know the time is short, and there is a lot of information in this from my standpoint. And so some of that you can refer to later, okay? First off, I'm a Christian man, and this has been my two verses concerning this from the time I found out. It's Colossians 4, 5, and 6. Conduct yourselves with wisdom towards outsiders, making the most of the opportunity, which I'm doing right now. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned, as it were, with salt, so that you may know how to respond to each person. And I want to conduct myself in that fashion. There's been a lot of things that have happened in this that other people have not conducted themselves correctly. Our son, there's a handout, is a TBI. That's a traumatic brain injury. He near drowned when he was 12 years old. Okay, it's in your handout. And I'm not going to go into that. He is severely impaired. His mother and I are his guardians. And this accident happened about 23 years ago. And to have a child, I don't know if anyone here has a child under the age of 12 or a parent or a grandparent that has Alzheimer's or dementia. That's what our life has been like. And about 15 years ago, we put him in a group home, and we assumed that he was being taken care of in that group home. And we don't keep up on the legislation that's passed, so we had no idea that this legislation had passed. In fact, we had originally got a conservatorship back in 1994, and the county administrator can't even tell me when it reverted to a guardianship because they changed the language, because he is incompetent. And I'm going to Jim's history because my motivation in this issue has been questioned. And my motivation is for my son, but I also want to inform this committee that there is over 15 other individuals that were exploited just like my son Jim was. His mom and I spend about half of our time in Montana as about 2 years ago, so we are no longer Minnesota voters. And so we did not vote this year in Minnesota. We voted in Montana, but we still spend time because Jim is in a group home here. We spend time coming back and forth. And we did not know that there was an issue that was brought forward in Crow Wing County until the middle of February. And a friend of mine called and he said, "Did you know that Jim had voted?" And I said, "No." I was absolutely livid. Absolutely livid. And to me, I said, "That's exploitation." Well, he says, "The law in Minnesota says it's okay for him to vote." What? No, they changed the legislation. If you're under guardianship, you can vote. Okay? So I call it the county attorney. The county attorney says we did an investigation on the voter fraud issue, and he closed the investigation because they didn't find anything wrong. And in the original affidavit that someone else filed, there was language of the exploitation of a vulnerable adult. Now you can refer to the vulnerable adult statute that you have in front of you, okay? And I'm not going to refer to a lot of points in there, but it covers a lot, even including the involuntary servitude, which is bringing somebody to vote, okay? Now, there are a lot of issues in that vulnerable adult statute that's there that actually been violated. And this is a personal, this ain't for you to decide, but in Crow Wing County, nothing has been done. And this, I've told my story to nine elected officials in Crow Wing County. And I went to the state licensing board, and nobody will look at it and take the time. The statute clearly lays out something is done wrong. And we put him in the care of a group home provider. And basically, he was a surrogate advocate for his mother and I when we were not there. We assumed that he was watching out for him, that he was not going to exploit him. And I didn't include Jim's neuropsychological report. If you give me your email address, I will email that to you, referring to Jim's competency. The group home owner knows from a personal level Jim's competency. And so there's no if, ands, or buts. He felt that he was okay because it is legal for Jim to vote. When he found out that we had started charges on the exploitation of a vulnerable adult, he sent my wife a voicemail that is threatening, and it's more than threatening. And I ain't going to go into that, and I will email that to you as well. The county attorney won't address that issue. This, he's above the law. I don't understand. All because it's legal for somebody under guardianship to vote. Now, he can't go and file his own restraining order against this threat that was made to him because he's under guardianship. He cannot serve on a jury because he's under guardianship. Now, he's been given the right to vote, and where you get the voters or where you get the jurors are from the voting list. Now, it seems to me like the cat chasing his tail here. It's like they're being used. My impression has been that for everyone that I've talked to, he is just a meal ticket. From social services to law enforcement to the county attorney to the licensing agency to the regional vulnerable adult ombudsman to the state director, Roberta Opheim, will not return my calls. And I believe in government. I do. And I really value our right to vote. It's how we can elect you officials to sit here and make laws that regulate us. And if somebody corrupts that in any way, it's just wrong. It's just wrong. Jim has four siblings, an older sister who he saved who was drowning, and he has a younger sister and two younger brothers who are 27 and 29. And when I told his 29-year-old brother, he got upset. He said, "What's Lynn doing?" He said, "If you told Jim to vote for Scooby-Doo, he'd vote for Scooby-Doo." And that was Jim's brother's reaction. And it just says it all. And he's been, we've looked through his financial records, and if they go out for pizza, he'll buy for everybody. Matthew's wife says, "Well, here's probably what they did. They said, Jim, let's go out and vote, and when we're done, you can buy pizzas when we're all done." There's no common sense. I don't know what's legal. And we didn't get a restraining order because I'm not an attorney. But I do know what's right and wrong. And this is definitely wrong.
5 minutes left, Mr. Steen.
Okay, I'm gonna close right there. And if you have any questions, you can ask me. I'm just wondering where the protection is. There is no protection. There's a letter there that you probably have a copy of it that I sent to Mark Dayton, to Lori Swanson, to Amy Cook, and to Kurt Zellers. And I'm appealing to them for help, and I'm appealing to you for help. And
we'll open it up for questions after both sides have testified, so okay. You can stick around. Dan Sievertson, I believe, is the last one that wanted to testify. Thank you, Mr. Steen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sievertson, about 3.5 minutes left. So,
no, I just wanted to...
please identify yourself for the record.
Dan Sievertson, live in Sauk Rapids. I have, when I first heard about this situation, did a little bit of research on it. I just want to very briefly bring out the hero in this whole process is Jim Steen. At the age of 12 years old, he saw his sister drown. He jumps in and, to threat of his own life, pulled her out, saved her life, and then went brain dead. And for 15 years, actually 23 years later, viewed by a disabled veteran who's voting early because he lives down the city, or he works down the city side, and had to vote early to get his vote to count, went in and saw a group home that was shipping individuals in to vote. And these individuals, some of them who would leave the ballot box, had their ballots filled out, and this is via his affidavit, by the members that were bringing them to the polls, putting them back in their hands, and then taking them back up to put them at the counter so that they could be counted. These are the individuals that Alan was talking about. These are the other 6 or 7 that are legally incapacitated who were really not able to make a sound decision. The bill that Representative Kiffmeyer has brought forward here is a righting of a wrong that took place in 2003 when this legislature determined that people under guardianship should have the opportunity to vote. And it's in opposition to the Constitution, and I want to thank her personally and the rest of the committee here for taking this on board and righting this wrong. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else, Representative Kiffmeyer? You got about a minute left.
No, Mr. Chairman. Okay. I will just leave the rest of the time, and Mr. Chairman would ask that I have an opportunity to make a closing remark instead.
Very good. The opponents, Carolyn Jackson first, I understand. If you've divided up your 20 minutes, that leaves you. We've had 4 people indicate interest in testifying in opposition. 5 minutes each, or if you want to divide it differently, the early ones, remember you're eating up the time for others if you go over.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got less than a page.
Very good. Welcome to our committee. If you can identify yourself for the record, you
may
proceed.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman. My name is Carolyn Jackson. I am the lobbying coordinator for the American Civil Liberties Union of Minnesota, funded and supported by over 8,500 members statewide. Our mission is to defend constitutional rights. The ACLU of Minnesota opposes House File 1119 because it burdens the right to vote of people under guardianship. Voting is a fundamental constitutional right protected under both the federal and the Minnesota constitutions. In fact, the right to vote is protected by more constitutional amendments, the 1st, 14th, 15th, 19th, 24th, and 26th, than any other right we enjoy as Americans. Minnesota statutes currently accommodate the voting rights of people under guardianship under federal constitutional law. However, if House File 1119 disturbs that system, and it raises equal protection concerns. In a 2007 case on this issue, the Eighth Circuit, looking at similar language under the Missouri Constitution, noted that under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment and the Americans with Disability Act, it would be improper to classify as ineligible to vote those people who are under guardianship for reasons unrelated to their ability to vote. The way current statutory law implements the Minnesota Constitution, there is recognition of the different abilities of persons under guardianship. I would point the committee's attention to another bill currently working its way through the Minnesota legislature, House File 1339. This bill would create the My Life, My Choices Task Force to create a system for people with disabilities which would support, among other things, the opportunity to live with minimal constraints instead of minimal freedoms. It would seem counterproductive for the legislature to work to lift procedural burdens from people with disabilities in other areas, but increase procedural burdens for voting. For those reasons, we urge the committee to vote no to House File 1119. Thank you.
Thank you. We have Justin Page. Welcome to our committee, Mr. Page. If you can identify yourself for the record, you may proceed. Again, keep in mind your time allowance.
Absolutely, and it shouldn't take you that long.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Justin Page, and I'm a staff attorney at the Minnesota Disability Law Center. The Minnesota Disability Law Center is part of the Legal Aid Society of Minneapolis. We represent individuals with all types of disabilities in the state of Minnesota. I'm here today to state our concerns about House File 1119, which would change the presumption regarding the ability of people under guardianship to vote and would require an annual court review of the issue. Under current law, individuals under guardianship have the right to vote unless the court finds that they are incompetent to vote and takes away that right. The state guardianship statute was revised in 2003 to bring Minnesota law into line with the Uniform Guardianship and Protection Proceedings Act. Minnesota law provides guardians only with the powers necessitated by the ward's limitations and demonstrated needs, with the goal of encouraging the development of the ward's maximum self-reliance and independence. Rather than making a global finding of incompetence in all areas, the court will limit the guardian's powers to a particular areas where the ward needs assistance after the ward's inability to make decisions in that area has been proven, for example, medical decisions or housing decisions. Consistent with the modern framework, an individual under guardianship is presumed to have the competence to vote and can vote unless the court makes a finding that the ward is incompetent to vote based on evidence placed before it. The determination of incompetence to vote becomes a part of the guardianship order. We were unable to get data on how many people currently under guardianship have had their right to vote taken away by court order. The current statutory framework is in line with the court's valid exercise of their authority to preserve a ward's right to vote, even while finding incompetence in other areas of decision-making. This updating was consistent with the long-standing judicial recognition of the importance of preserving the fundamental right to vote where possible. Prior to the modernization of the guardianship statute, when sweeping guardianship orders were the norm, courts would appropriately exercise their authority to preserve a ward's right to vote in the guardianship order after reviewing their competency. House File 1119 is inconsistent with the 2003 updating of the state guardianship statute. It removes the presumption that an individual has the right to vote, and contrary to other aspects of the decision-making under guardianship, places the burden on the ward to prove competence to vote. This restriction, focused solely on voting, lacks adequate justification, as current law and practice already provides a mechanism for courts to keep people under guardianship who lack capacity to vote from voting. This blanket change may invite equal protection challenges from affected individuals. Moreover, the proposed legislation would place an additional heavy burden on our already overburdened court system. There are approximately 23,000 people under guardianship in Minnesota, and the legislation requires an annual court review, reassessment, and order on the question of voting competence for every individual under guardianship, regardless of the factual basis for that guardianship. We urge you to vote against this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Page. Ms. Knuth, and then Ms. Frazier. Welcome to our committee. If you can identify yourself for the record, you may proceed. Thank you.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sherry Knuth, and I am Public Policy Coordinator for League of Women Voters Minnesota. It is the position of the League of Women Voters that voting is a fundamental citizen right that must be guaranteed. This bill would place an undue burden on that right. The current system strikes the appropriate balance between protecting the right to vote for individuals under guardianship while preserving the ability of the courts to limit the right to vote of people who have been proven incompetent to do so. League of Women Voters also believes that the provisions that require an annual court review of every ward's capacity to vote is excessively burdensome to the guardian and the ward and a misuse of judicial resources. I urge you to vote against House File 1119. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Knuth. Any relationship to a representative that serves in the House? Ms. Frazier, welcome to the committee. Identify yourself for the record. Yes. About 10 minutes left. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Beth Frazier with the Office of the Secretary of State. And I just wanted to state that we strongly oppose this legislation, as it would deprive many individuals who are competent to vote of their right to vote. And I think the real question isn't whether these individuals have the right to vote, but it's about assistance to voters and what is appropriate assistance to voters and what is not appropriate assistance to voters. And under Minnesota statute, individuals are allowed to have assistance in voting, but they must direct the person assisting them in how they want to vote. Individuals assisting voters under Minnesota statutes 204C.15 are specifically prohibited from trying to influence a voter. They may not, to quote, request, persuade, induce, or attempt to persuade or induce the voter to vote for or against a particular candidate. And violating this statute is a felony. The voter must be able to indicate their preference, and then the assistant is allowed to mark their ballot. If the individual cannot indicate their preference, or then they are not allowed, then the assistant is not allowed to mark the ballot. The individual must be able to tell the assistant how to mark the ballot. If the ballot is being marked and the voter did not indicate how it should be marked, then that is a violation of law, and under 204C.41, that is a felony. And so I think the real question here is about inappropriate or potentially inappropriate assistance to voters, not about who has or should have the right to vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Frazier. Members, any questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for the author and for you, Mr. Chair. Has a fiscal note been requested on this bill?
Representative Giffmeyer.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Has a fiscal note been requested?
No, Mr. Chairman.
No.
Representative Hillstrom. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And where is this going to next?
Next is GovOps.
GovOps elections, Mr. Chairman.
GovOps elections.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This has a significant impact on the judiciary, and I would make a request that a fiscal note be requested from the judiciary. Currently, you go to court if you want to find someone not capable of voting, and this would say that everyone is not capable, and you have to go to court to prove that you're capable. And so I would assume that the majority of folks who would want to vote and exercise their right would be doing so. So I would anticipate that this would be a huge expense to the judiciary, and I would expect that it would end up in Representative Smith's committee. Is that correct, Mr. Chair?
I'll do some checking and let you know.
Mr. Chairman, I can speak.
Representative Kiffmeyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Also intended to go to Representative Smith's committee?
I know that it's going next to GovOps elections, and from there that's one possibility.
Okay.
But I don't presume upon the chair or the committee, next committee, for their decision, Mr. Chairman. But as to the issue here, just to let you know that 524.5-316 in my bill, there already is an annual report of the guardian. I, as the guardian, already submit that report. That is already read by the court, acted on by the court, reviewed by the court. Matter of fact, on subdivision 1.5, a recommendation as to the need for continued guardianship and any recommended changes in the scope of the guardianship are currently in Minnesota law. What we're adding here is just including whether, in the view of the guardian, the ward's eligibility to vote should be rescinded, restored, or continue unchanged. So that is already in law, a recommendation as to the need for continued guardianship. Also, in addition, on page 7, line 21, the annual review, the court already has a system for monitoring guardianships. Reports are already submitted. The court does already review them. As in current law, you have a recommendation as the need for continued and making any changes. That's already in statute. The court already reviews any of those changes. So I do not see that this necessarily does add to the cost to the court, because it's a procedure and a process that is already in place and already required by law. We're just adding a specific component in regards to this particular issue.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I will direct you to line 7.22 and 7.23, where the language specifically states the court shall issue a written determination on whether or not the ward has the capacity to make an independent voting decision. I am certain that that's not in current statute, and any time you direct the court to make a written determination, and we're told it has a fiscal note.
Representative Kiffmeyer and Representative Hillstrom, we do have a request for judiciary to also see this bill, so just as of now, they would be seeing it as well, just so you know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
There's another question, Mr. Chairman, from Representative Holberg. I know you might not be able to.
Representative Hilty and then Representative Holberg. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kiffmeyer, I'm just trying to grasp how this process would work. We heard some very compelling, sort of emotional testimony from Mr. Steen about the situation regarding his son, and I look at this bill and I don't really see how this bill would do anything to rectify the situation that he described, because what you're requiring here is a report from the guardian, and I believe what Mr. Steen was alleging is that the guardian, that is the director of the group home to which he was in which he was housed, was the person that exploited him by presumably basically just voting for him however the director chose to vote or tell him to vote. Well, what your bill is requiring is that the guardian makes a recommendation as to whether the ward is competent to vote or not. Wouldn't the person that allegedly exploited this gentleman have made, I mean, if that was his intention, wouldn't he have made a recommendation to the court that this person was, in fact, competent to vote? Would you expect that the court in every situation would somehow cause the ward to appear before a judge and have the judge make that determination? Your bill is saying that the determination would be made on the recommendation of the guardian and that that constitutes prima facie evidence. So could you explain to me how this bill would address the problem that was described by Mr. Steen?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hilty, there is a situation here right now that in realizing that in the situation with Mr. Steen and his son and in the group home, there already is a law on the books there in regards to a violation there, I believe, of what was happening there. And in even seeking redress of that grievance from by his father as an advocate for his son, the law was not followed. And so what we are doing as guardians here is that there's a step here that at least the guardian has the opportunity, and by the way, not all guardians would necessarily want to make that request to the court and to have that decision, but it is an opportunity that those who want a voting right to be restored to request of the court to do so. But what we're not saying that 100% of all those who are under guardianship will want their right to vote to be restored, such as Mr. Steen and my sister and others as well. And so I think the number of those who might seek that, we don't know that number out of those 23,000 that would be in a situation where they would want to have it. In regards to the prima facie evidence, the court has a very significant file on every ward that's under guardianship. There's neurological, there's assessments, there's psychology, there's physical assessments, there are life skills, there are a whole variety of them that are a part of the whole file that the court has on anybody who was initially placed under guardianship, because you have to justify that. There are documents that are submitted to the court that justify as to your status and your need for guardianship. And so the court has a substantial amount of documents, as well as the annual report of the guardian as well, to use in making that determination. But Representative Hilty, there were two things here. One had to do with the process and the prima facie and going through that process. The other one was the fact that this young man very obviously seems to have been exploited. There already are laws in regards to that, but when his father, on his behalf as his guardian, went to the county attorney, went to others as well, to implement that law in the vulnerable and exploitation situation, much less voting, it was not acted upon. So the one thing, those are already in law, the one thing that we can seek and do here is align the law with the Constitution and also give a process for restoration of that vote. So you're right, absolutely, in that regard. But this bill was not intended to redress, because there's already statute for that. How could I write anything more than what was in that present statute? But what I can do something about as a guardian, again from the perspective of a guardian, is to seek to change the law in a way that I could have an opportunity without it costing thousands of dollars to hire an attorney, and there is no other process in statute for me as a guardian other than a general recommendation, but it does not address. You have to remember that if I did that, there's a conflict between the Constitution and the statute. So if I'm going to go to the court and do that, the first thing they're going to say is, well, I have this law, and then you have this Constitution. And I think we in the legislature should, first of all, address the situation before telling all kinds of people just go to court when we have a known conflict between the Constitution and the law. How would a court be able to answer that with that conflict? So my bill addresses both of them, gives a process, and also aligns the Constitution and the statute.
Follow-up, Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Kiffmeyer, thanks for clarifying the earlier testimony, because it didn't seem to me that, I mean, you know, it was represented as being in support of this bill, but what it really was testimony for the necessity of current law being followed. My question is, you referred to the documentation that the court is already in possession of regarding the guardianship and the placement of anyone as in need of guardianship. Is it your, under the current provisions for the annual report, does the court refer to all of that documentation as part of its review of the annual report?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My understanding of Representative Hilty is that when any guardian submits their annual report, but usually prior to that, there is a determination of the need for guardianship. And so a file is created at that time, which is rather substantial. And that is generally to be the case. I don't know how you would do it otherwise. And the court would have that access to those documents and to that material. And generally speaking, when you file an annual report, also the court is aware of the ongoing status of the ward as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, I'm somewhat doubtful that in its review of the annual reports, the court actually refers to all of that initial documentation under current circumstances. But if I'm reading your bill correctly, you're assuming that that would, in fact, take place if this bill becomes law. And so, given that, it does seem to me that there would be a considerable additional burden on the courts to refer back to all of this original documentation annually and write a and submit a written report based on that thorough review of the situation. Am I misunderstanding this?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hilty. The need of the court to review the documents is at their choice. I would say there would be many cases at which the court would be familiar enough, the documents presented would be substantial enough already that they would be able to make a fairly smooth short amount of time in reviewing these things. Many of these are very, very obvious, so I believe that. On the other hand, we want to make sure that if the court wanted to, it is their choice to review any material that is at hand.
Representative Holbert, you've done Representative
Mr. Chair, just a brief comment. It just appears to me that the assumption here is that if someone under guardianship is going to be exploited by someone with regard to their voting activity, that the person that would be in position to exploit that person would be the guardian. If someone else were involved in that, it would be a violation of current law. Since we're regarding, since we're relying basically on the evidence presented by the guardian about whether the ward is capable of voting or not, I don't see anything here that would actually prevent the kind of exploitation that presumably this bill is intended to prevent. So that's where I am with this.
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, given the time, I'm going to pass.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to follow up on Representative Holbert's statement that this would put everyone's...
Representative Lesch, if I can just pause. Somebody's seemingly might have a cell phone on. If you have members, can you check? Or Representative Kiffmeyer?
It might be my loose filling, Mr. Chair.
I don't think it's the heat you're packing, Representative Lesch. Go, go on.
I can heat, Mr. Chair. The question related, Representative Hillstrom stated that now all these would be up for court review now, but I think as correctly stated by Representative Hilty, it would be just those that would be challenged by a guardian, unless I'm mistaken. My question is, which section specifically under the Vulnerable Adults Statute would you say was violated, at least with respect to, for example, Mr. Steen's case?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Lesch, I am prepared to present my bill, but I do not have the statute. But the Secretary of State's office testified as to an election statute. Mr. Steen, I believe, was referring in general to the vulnerable adult, but I believe we have some, maybe some county attorneys or others in the... here today that might be able to speak to that if necessary.
Mr. Chair, if I can, the question is pretty specific because this this bill seeks to address it under a address the problem under a separate section of a statute with respect to, well, just a different section of statute. So I'm wondering if justice, or at least with respect to how certain victims would like justice to be redressed, was not found under the vulnerable adult statute, which was the section that failed there, such that we're now here on this voting issue.
Representative Kiffmeyer, do you have further comment, or does Mr. Steen want to answer that?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lesh, Mr. Steen just said it was the involuntary servitude in particular. But again, there are a variety of statutes that our law covers. There's one on the elections, 24C.15, and I believe so on, that they were there in regards to improperly assisting someone to vote. That's one of those areas. The exploitation, involuntary servitude, they're number ones that I would say that might have impacted the fact that you have a person who obviously is in a situation of needing assistance, but was helped more than, and I think, Representative Lesh, you're going into an area of a whole variety of other statutes, again, that if they're valid and you think that they're already there and they haven't been followed, that is a legal issue, and certainly one that Mr. Steen tried to use to no avail. What do you expect him more to do except to at least take the avenue that we can do, the responsible thing as a guardian, with the knowledge we have that you have the Constitution, which clearly says that if you're under guardianship, you're not eligible to vote, nor shall you be permitted to vote, and you have a statute that contradicts it. We're just taking a step right here as in a guardian process to do what we can. It doesn't mean that we necessarily need to change those other laws. They're amply there. But having no avail there, having them not being of help to him in this situation with his son, we can at least go to this part of the area and take an action as a guardian responsibly would do for what they can do in regards to their own persons that they are responsible for.
Well, let's see if I can ask this then, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh.
Representative Kiffmeyer, if you can tell me, this bill presumes to have a guardian make a determination on whether or not a vulnerable adult or a ward should be allowed to vote. Who then is watching the guardians to determine whether they're qualified to make that determination?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Representative Lesh, first of all, the language does not say determination. That is a different kind of legal one that we have left to the judge, because the judge has the authority and the responsibility to make that determination. It is only in an advisory capacity. It says, in the view of the guardian. It's an opinion to the court about the ward's eligibility to vote. And so it is simply a statement of opinion by the guardian, not a statement of determination. But it is an opportunity for the guardian to express an opinion. And certainly most often in those cases, the guardians work closely with those who are there. They are in charge to take care of them. They're required. The annual report asks how many times you've personally seen your ward and a variety of other questions like that. Physical assessment, are they living in the same place? There's just lots of information that the guardian is required to know as part of that. And then it just seems like a very obvious common sense thing that they would, whether in the view of the guardian, they would express that opinion. But it is only where I've used the word determination as to the ward's capacity to make independent voting decisions is left to the court.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, are you saying that it's illegal for a guardian to render that kind of an opinion now?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lesh, it is not illegal for them to make such a request at this time.
Okay. Well, I think you answered the other question more briefly then in that sense, Representative Kiffmeyer. We are making a change in this bill, and you are launching a situation which was not before the purview of the court into the purview of a court simply by means of rendering an opinion. Maybe you can tell me this, Representative Kiffmeyer. Can you assure me that a guardian would be qualified to read and assess and correctly analyze a neuropsychological report to determine whether or not their ward is qualified to vote?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lesh, there is no requirement here for any guardian to make any such of type of thing of neurological charts. They are a guardian, and they rely upon the expertise of physicians and doctors, and those items are submitted most often to the court in the original process of having guardianship established. But this does not expect them, nor ask them, nor require them. It simply says whether in the view of the guardian. Just simply that, Representative Lesh.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, if I can, just I won't have any more questions here, but just by way of comment, I don't think it is that simple, clearly based on the questions in the first place, Representative Kiffmeyer. I'm pretty sure that if Representative Mahoney were asked to render an opinion on whether I'm qualified to vote, he'd say no, and he would need to see a neuropsychological report to do it. So I'm a little bit...
I wouldn't be the only one.
That's, well, again, that's your opinion. Thank God it's just an opinion and won't be launched into a court case. We don't have any laws which say it would be turned into a court case. So I'm deeply concerned that this goes down that slippery a slope of deciding who we want to vote and who we don't want to vote. Members, I've prosecuted cases under vulnerable adult statutes for 10 years. I'm hard pressed to see under which section of that statute this would have fallen, and if the county attorney made a mistake, maybe they did, but I, for the life of me, can't figure out where it is. But nonetheless, I don't know why we'd be able to put guardians in a position of engendering court cases where now there aren't any, just because we want to take the franchise away from an individual. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I would clarify again, the guardian
Representative Kiffmeyer, quickly, I don't think Representative Lesh had a question, but if you want to quickly respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to clarify that there's no legal statement here being required by a guardian. It is a opinion, and again, it is the court, and the court is already engaged in guardianship issues. The court is already involved, is already engaged, and even under the previous statute. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer. Actually, I'm looking at the list members. I'm next on the list, if that's okay, and then we've got Representative Simon and Mahoney. Just quickly, I had a just a couple of observations. I know Representative Hillstrom was talking earlier, and others were, about the interaction between the guardian and the courts, and the volley of debate around how much time that is going to take in supposedly writing all this up. I would expect, and Representative Kiffmeyer, as you maybe respond to some of this, you're maybe aware of some of the forms. I would expect these are forms that they would review annually. If the form changes and the box changes on the form from one to the other, that it would probably be as simple as that, I would expect, from a practical sense. I'd be interested in your comments around that, but my question really revolves around line 1.11, and looking at the language under the Constitution, it does seem very clear. As a matter of fact, 1.10 refers to the part in the Constitution. It says a person not meeting the above requirements, and then it says a person who has been convicted of a felony or of treason or felony unless restored to civil rights. So 1.10 aligns with that very well. It says convicted of treason or a felony whose civil rights have not been restored. Going back to the Constitution, it says a person under guardianship. And then we see in statute on 1.11, it says, again, an individual who is not eligible to vote is a person who is B, under a guardianship in which, and then the current language, the court order revokes the ward's right to vote. So I'm curious about the history of that, because if we look at the next one, 1.13, it again seems to align very well with the Constitution. The Constitution says, or a person who is, the words of the day, of course, when the Constitution was developed, this item, who is insane or not mentally competent. 1.13 again says, found by a court of law to be legally incompetent. So it's very congruent, Representative Kiffmeyer, with that last segment of the Constitution. So I'm curious around the history of the development of 1.11 relative to the other two items there in the Constitution and their respective parts in statute. They don't have the that item does not have the congruence that the other two do. So anyway, long question, but interested in your quick comments, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In regards to aligning the statute with the Constitution, I think it speaks for itself and on its face speaks very, very well as to the understanding of the writers of the Constitution and the need to protect those who are in those situations. And it's a protective approach, recognizing in particular for that. And I think that, Mr. Chairman, that the Constitution is very clear in that regard, and I would say that once we as legislators know what the Constitution says, you know, are we just going to turn our face away from our own Minnesota Constitution that we swore to uphold and say it doesn't matter and we'll just go ahead and write laws that don't fit with our Constitution? And I think is a very important position to take, and my role here at making sure that we have a process to restore that right, which was is in there, to make sure that is explicit in the law, to make sure that both the courts and the guardians who are given copies of these laws and informed of them and changes in them know their rights, know their responsibilities, and that this is one of them. We have a clear case where that was. And Mr. Chairman, just to clarify also in a previous question, I received the statute that Representative responded to as well, but I will just wait for other questions, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Drazkowski, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quick follow-up, Representative Kiffmeyer. You talked about earlier, and, you know, this does seem to be, I guess, I don't know if the word compromise is right, but it's more of a compromise from what if we were going to write in a statute to have it, again, reflect the true clear statement that is there in the Constitution, we would just say item B, who is under guardianship, period. And if somebody, according to a judge in a court of law, had the ability to vote, there would probably be another sort of legal classification for them, a conservatorship, as you suggested, or maybe something else. But it's very clear in the Constitution, if they're under guardianship, the Constitution says they shouldn't be legal to vote. You know, my opinion is 1.11 should say under a guardianship. Just a comment, not really needing a response, Representative Kiffmeyer. Thank you, members.
Representative Kiffmeyer, any answer?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've never met Jim Steen, and I've never met Representative Kiffmeyer, your younger sister, but I have met people, including my own first cousin, who lives in a group home and is under guardianship, and I know enough just from that to know that it's not a one-size-fits-all approach, that different people under different guardianship circumstances are in those circumstances for different reasons. They have different cognitive abilities for one reason or another, and they can be as varied as possible. That's the situation that they find themselves in. I think that Representative Drazkowski is right, that the nub of the bill here is line 1.11, and forgive me, I stepped out of the room for a few minutes. I had a bill up in another committee, so if this has been repeated or gone over, I apologize, but that is the nub of the bill. It's changing the presumption. And so now, under current law, you can vote if you're under guardianship unless a judge revokes the right to vote. And now the presumption is completely changed. Now it's you can't vote unless a judge has reinstated it. That's really the heart of the bill. It's completely reversing the presumption. So we're going from you can unless to you can't unless for someone under guardianship. And I have to say I'm very uncomfortable with that. Representative Drozdowski is also, I think, being intellectually honest when he says, look, I mean, in his opinion, maybe we should just say you can't vote at all in statute because by some interpretations that's consistent with the Constitution. I think that's a I appreciate his intellectual honesty there. I think if someone had the belief that our current law was out of sync with the state constitution, they could challenge the law. They could just go to court and seek a declaratory judgment that that the law was unconstitutional on its face because the Constitution says guardianship, and it means guardianship in all instances. I think that person would lose because my understanding is the court cases say that you can qualify what guardianship, what that guardianship restriction means. I'm looking here at the Secretary of State's handout here. I think all members should have it here, and I don't know if anyone's already gone over this, but I think it's a true statement of current law when, under the first major heading under the gray box, it says, in Minnesota, only a court may decide whether an individual is competent to vote. Whether that's good or bad or right or wrong, I think that is a true and accurate statement of current law. And so it doesn't surprise me. I'm not trying to pour salt in any family's wound. I'm just going to say from a legal standpoint, it doesn't surprise me that the Crow Wing County Attorney, in looking at this case, said, I'm sorry, but under current law, not what's right or wrong or otherwise, but under current law, it is true that unless a judge has taken that right away, that person has the right to vote, hence the bill, I assume. So I understand the family's frustration at any exploitation of their son. I really do. But under current law, I think it's a true statement that only a court may decide. That is true. And I can't say I blame the county attorney for saying that his or her hands are tied. I don't know who the county attorney is there. So, and otherwise, Representative Kiffmeyer, you wouldn't need this bill. So under current law, I think that's true. And the other thing worth noting, as the handout does, under the third paragraph, under the gray box, is that it is a felony currently to in any way influence a voter's choices. And it seems to me that if we have true instances of exploitation, that is where, primarily where, our emphasis should lie. That if someone is abusing the system, and if someone is taking people in to vote who, for whatever reason, shouldn't be voting, we should throw the book at them. Absolutely. I think that's where it should lie. Rather than taking away the person's right to vote, I think the emphasis should be on absolutely coming down hard on people who exploit vulnerable adults in our society in any way, frankly, not just when it comes to whispering in their ear, who ought to vote for it. I have no tolerance for that whatsoever. So I guess this is a comment more than a question. We just differ on our approach here. I understand and sympathize with the family here, but I don't think it's quite fair to say that, and I've never met, I don't even know who the Crow Wing County Attorney is, so I'm not a shill for him or her, but I think it's a current, correct statement of law that only a court may decide. And again, I just go back to line 1.11. Let's just talk about what this bill really is. It's reversing the presumption so that from now on it's much, much harder for someone under guardianship to vote.
Representative Hillstrom's next. But Mr. Page and Ms. Jackson, after this, I've got a question for you, if you can be ready to come down. Representative Hillstrom will ask a question first. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr.
Then Representative Mahoney after my question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kiffmeyer, if you could actually walk me through how this would happen, I'm going to explain. Okay, so the guardian says, no, I don't think the ward is capable to vote. And the ward says, yes, I am. I think I'm capable to vote. And I want to get the decision that I can't vote reviewed. How does the ward get back before the court to have the court review whether or not they are should be eligible to vote?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hillstrom. As part of the annual guardianship process, the guardian is also required to distribute to the ward a notice that they have the right to appeal to the court to have their guardianship status changed. And so as a part of the annual process that you go through, there is an actual provided by the court that the guardian is responsible to deliver to the ward that explains their rights and their opportunities and their recourse. I don't have all that page memorized, but it's something that is required to be given to the ward, and that would usually be the point at which the ward had the ability and capability to read and to understand and exercise that, that would be the opportunity for the ward to speak to the fact that maybe when that is given to them, maybe they have wonderfully been healed in such a way that they have that capacity. And then that's why that is given to them, is ordered to be given to them, and is submitted to them as a part of the annual process of a guardianship's responsibilities before the court.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this restoration of the right to vote would be part of this larger package that shows or tells the ward, this is how you stop having a guardian, or this is how you change having a guardian. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hillstrom, when it is just, yes, it is information for the ward to let them know how to rescind their guardianship, to take any action. It's a form that is provided by the court that is then given to the ward, but it isn't just a matter of particularly about voting, but it is also a matter of any changes in the status of their guardianship at all. I mean, it's an opportunity for the ward to have that and make use of that for any reason whatsoever that they would choose.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if the ward wants to get back before the court, not on the annual review, is there a court fee that's charged for this review hearing, or does someone actually have to file paperwork with the court, or how does it actually get back before the court? Because I can see where maybe this year I am not doing very well if I'm a ward, and it's coming upon an election year and my review time isn't quite up, but I think I can make a decision about who I want to vote for, and so I want to get that reviewed in a timely fashion so I can vote. How would that actually happen so that a ward could get back before the court in time to vote?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hillstrom, I just stated again the opportunity for the ward to make any changes to the status of their guardianship is there for them. Basically, most often, frequently, they're given that notice through that annual process. It would be up to the ward at that point to exercise that right. I do not know that if there is a fee in regards to that, but again, the guardian that has the responsibility for the ward, and if the ward wishes to take that action, the guardian would be required to assist the ward in regards to taking that. That's their job. That's their job as a guardian, is to assist the person that they're taking care of, to not only give them that, but if the ward would express a desire to change anything whatsoever, they would communicate that also with the guardian, or independently be able to contact the court. But again, the presumption there would be then that the ward would have that ability to realize, to read, and to understand, and to comprehend that. Otherwise, the guardian would be responsible. That's why you have a guardian, is to take care.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just don't necessarily think that someone has to be able to read a legal document and be able to understand a legal process in order to be competent enough to make a decision on who they may or may not like for president, or who they may or may not like for state representative. And so I really think that this is a very large burden that you're placing on the ward in order to get them to have the capability of being eligible to vote. And if the, person who is overseeing the ward is believes that the ward is not capable of voting, and they will have done that because they'll put that in the report, they may not necessarily be that helpful in helping the ward to overcome this high burden of getting back before the court. I really think that it should be, the burden should be, to take the voters' rights away. Voting is a right. It isn't a privilege. It's a right. And I think that this bill actually flips that on its head and puts the burden in the wrong place.
Representative Kiffmeyer, response, but isn't your bill essentially going back the way it was prior to 203? 2003.
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly right. This is what was in law up until 2003, and also in regards to returning it to that status that was there in 2003, I have, in recognition of other court situations, have also added that knowing and that process that is there in that second part of the bill as well.
Mr. Chair, just one final comment.
Representative Billstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Weren't you Secretary of State in 2003, and wasn't Governor Pawlenty the governor in 2003?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Hillstrom. I was at that time, and this was part of a package of law that I was not aware. It did not go through an elections process. We've looked back into the history of this. How did it come into being? And the fact that it was in that situation was something that I, at the time that particular law was passed, I was not aware that action was being taken. And so I did not testify in that committee or address that issue.
Well, Mr.
At
Chair,
that time.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. Not only
that you said last.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. She just gets me going here on these issues sometimes. But you were Secretary of State, and you did have the responsibility for election law. The legislature was controlled in the Minnesota House by the Republicans, and you had a Republican governor. I find it very, very difficult to believe that no one knew that this was happening. That's all, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hellstrom, we've actually done a little checking on that because I had the same question. It came through all things a uniform probate code changing bill. So,
Mr. Chair, everyone is responsible to read the bills before they become law, before they're signed. And the people who have jurisdiction over these issues do have an obligation to make sure they understand what's becoming law. And that's all, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, we've got the bill in front of us, changing it back from now to prior to 2003, and that's the issue. Representative Mahoney, the chair is going to pass on his question at this point today.
So am I.
Members, I think we've discussed this long enough. The chair is ready to take a vote.
Chairman, if I could just
Representative Kiffmeyer, closing comments, brief, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, but I just did want to just clarify that our right to vote is also part of being age, residency, a U.S. citizen. It's not an absolute right. It is one of those rights that we do have qualifications to meet, and we do have a genuine Minnesota Constitution to work with. And in regards to the vote, absolutely, if it is the ward's vote, we want it to be that way, but not somebody else's. And the situation here is that under statutes that we have in regards to protecting those who are vulnerable, we have a very serious responsibility. And so my bill here today, Mr. Chairman, is taking responsibility for the situation that it is, restoring the language back to where it fits with the Constitution, and also in protecting those who are able to vote to make sure that we have a process by which they can have their right to vote restored. And I think, Mr. Chairman, this is a balanced bill, and I would ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Ask for a roll call, please.
Representative Simon has asked for a roll call. Representative Kiffmeyer, I'm going to amend my motion, and I understand judiciary does want it, and so we need to send it there first. Representative, so the chair amends his motion, House File 1119 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Judiciary Committee.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Holberg.
If I might, I heard that it also has to go to GovOps. I don't know if your companions made deadline in the Senate, but it would probably make sense for it to get through the other policy committee before you send it to the Finance Committee.
Representative Holberg, those are logistics. This is the chair's best opinion at this point in time.
All right. Thank you.
With that, on the amended motion, the clerk will take the roll.
Representative Westrom?
Yes.
Representative Druskowski?
Yes.
Representative Lesch?
No.
Representative Grunhagen? Representative Hillstrom?
No.
Representative Hilty?
No.
Representative Holberg?
Yes.
Representative Hoppe? Representative Hortman. Representative Mahoney.
No.
Representative Mazerall.
Yes.
Representative Pepin. Representative Peterson. Representative Runbeck.
Yes.
Representative Scott.
Yes.
Representative Simon.
No.
Representative Wardlow.
Yes.
She said yes. Representative Holberg.
Yes.
Vote of six to five, the bill passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Giffmeyer. Next, we've got Representative Mazerall, House File 770. Welcome. Representative Simon, you're welcome to take a coffee break if you're here. Representative Mazerall moves House File 770 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Judiciary. Is that what you understand through Representative Mazerall?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
You may proceed. Brevity will be appreciated by the committee at this time of the day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 770 is a bill that amends Minnesota Statutes 549.09 relating to interest on judgments and awards. The statute currently provides for interest based on a one-year treasury bill where the amount of judgment or award is $50,000 or less and 10% if it's more than $50,000. This bill makes the one-year treasury note the basis regardless of the size of the judgment or award.
Do you want your testifiers to go, Representative Mazerall?
Mr. Chair, I have two testifiers, and
okay.
Yes, I believe they are ready to proceed.
Welcome to our committee. Introduce yourself for the records. You may proceed.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson. I'm with the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, but I'm here this evening as a...
Can you get the microphone closer, Mr. Johnson?
All right. We'll have to shuffle here a little. It's Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota, but I'm here this evening as a board member of Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform. It's a formal organization in Minnesota comprised of in excess of 58,000 employers in the state who are working together for a series of reforms to our civil justice system. Our overall goal is to get a more balanced, predictable, efficient, and affordable civil justice system in the state. We are here this evening to strongly support and urge passage of House File 770 to help accomplish that goal. Very briefly, Mr. Chairman and committee members, that the history of the statute of Representative Mazerall has indicated is that a few years ago this legislature made a decision to increase the rate that had been in effect, which was basically a 4% interest floor, increased it 150% to go to a 10% fixed rate for judgments in excess of $50,000. That was 2 years ago. Last year, then, the legislature made a decision to put governmental entities at the previous 4% rate and keep the private sector at the higher 10% rate. And we're here this evening, the way the bill is it's introduced, it equalizes the rate and it brings the private sector back to the rate that the government entities were put in Minnesota in the 2010 session. We think that's equitable. We think the rate as it's proposed is a fair rate. It makes more sense. We are at a high rate. We have one other witness that I'd like to have briefly speak to underscore some of the reasons why we think this is an important bill, an important change, and it's supported by the Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform Organization.
Sir, if you could identify yourself with the tape, that'd be great. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Court Sylvester, and I am a lawyer with the Nylon Johnson Lewis firm in Minneapolis. I practice in the area of civil litigation. I've represented both individuals and businesses on both sides of the V in civil lawsuits. My primary practice today is on behalf of employers in manufacturing and other industries, both based in Minnesota and elsewhere. And HF 770, which would return us to the pre-2009 prejudgment interest rate, is of great interest to my clients and to myself and my colleagues. The change wrought in 2009 was a sea change in the way prejudgment interest operated in Minnesota, and what I can tell you tonight is how that change is playing out in practice in civil litigation in this state. We have seen an enormous impact on my clients and on our practice. I can tell you that settlement demands that my clients are receiving in their cases now include a huge component of prejudgment interest, and it's changing the way they are attempting, that the plaintiff's lawyers are attempting to leverage settlement pressure in Minnesota. My understanding is that part of the basis for the change made in 2009 was a comparison of Minnesota's rate to that found in some other states. But the question is not whether we should do as Wisconsin or North Dakota or other states do. The question is, what is right and fair in terms of the level of prejudgment interest? And the current punitive prejudgment interest rate is simply unfair and not rationally tied to any sort of legitimate touchstone. The time between the notice of a claim and the time when a judgment might be rendered is largely beyond the control of the litigants, particularly of the defendant who has been hailed into court and who, in the event of a judgment, would be liable to pay that prejudgment interest. And this is particularly a concern in a state like Minnesota, where we have what is, in relation to other states, a very long statute of limitations. I can give you the example. Just today, I received a notice of claim against one of my clients for an incident that occurred in October 2010. A negligence lawsuit could be filed based on that incident as late as October of 2016, and a judgment might not be rendered until 4 or 5 years later. You could have 10 years or so of interest racking up on that judgment at a very punitive rate, which is not tied to any sort of calculation or touchstone of what the market is doing right now. We are in this state committed to market forces, and all the proposed legislation does is link the interest that would be charged as prejudgment interest on a judgment to some rational relationship to the prevailing interest market that is determined by those forces. The current number is not tied to that at all. It's simply big, and it creates a windfall for those who obtain judgments, a windfall that is not related in any way to the conduct of the parties in the case or the extent to which that recovery is deserved. So HF 770 takes away, to some extent, that windfall. It provides an appropriate balance between the interests of having prejudgment interest and the way in which that interest rate is determined. There is still a floor when we go back to the pre-2009 area of 4%. It would prevent us from divesting people of a legitimate amount of interest, but it would also ensure that there is a rational constraint tied to what the market is doing and to what people can get in terms of a rate of return on their money. And that's the kind of constraint that ought to be taken into account when setting the rate of prejudgment interest. So for all of those reasons, as this legislation would play out in practice, it would be far more related to the values that should guide our decision-making in Minnesota to return to the level that this legislation proposes. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, members? I know we have a couple, at least one or two opponents, Representative Mazeroff. I think to speed things up, I would like to offer the A2 amendment, and I think it would be more constructive of their testimony if we have the A2 amendment in front of us. The chair will move the A2 amendment to House File 770. With that, Mr. Gehring has a technical change, and I'll ask him to read that for the committee.
Mr. Chair, so the addition to the A2 amendment, you can see on line 1.3 of the amendment, it would read page 2, line 27, after yield, insert plus 8 percentage points if the judgment or award is over $50,000, comma. So, Mr. Chair, I'll read the whole paragraph.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Gehring.
With the A2 amendment, with this addition, the paragraph in the bill would read, on or before the 20th day of December of each odd-numbered year, the state court administrator shall determine the rate from the one-year constant maturity treasury yield for the most recent calendar month, reported on a monthly basis in the latest statistical release of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. This yield, plus 8 percentage points if the judgment or award is over $50,000, rounded to the nearest 1%, or 4%, whichever is greater, shall be the annual interest rate for verdicts entered during the succeeding two calendar years.
Everybody have that amendment as amended?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mazzaro?
Mr. Chair, I'll accept that as a friendly amendment.
Very good. We'll incorporate the A2 amendment as amended orally into House File 770. Actually, Representative Mazzaro, I think we should all just take a vote on that, but to get that in the shape, let's take a vote on the A2 amendment as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Members, essentially, that would set the rate at 8% floating instead of 10%, but judgments under $50,000, $50,000 and under would still remain at 4%. With that, I think we'll call the two opponents, or the one opponent. I think there might be a second one. Joel Carlson, Representative Hillstrom, in the meantime, you have a question.
Yes, Mr. Chair, this is a process question. Where is this bill going next?
Judiciary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You will see it again.
Thank you.
Mr. Carlson, welcome to the committee. You know the routine. identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. I have with me Jim Carey, who is the president of the Association for Justice, the attorney at the Stephen Gross Fund, Holtman Carey, a firm in downtown Minneapolis. And I think I'll let him go first and backfill on anything that is needed relative to the bill now as amended.
As amended, Mr. Carey, if you can testify to that, brevity would be appreciated, but we certainly want to make sure you've conveyed to the committee your concerns. Identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, I think by way of background, so people understand, the purpose of the interest payment is to encourage prompt payment.
If you can identify yourself just for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Record. Jim Carey, Mr. Chairman, President of the Minnesota Association for Justice.
Very good. Thank you.
The purpose of the interest provision is to encourage prompt resolution, encourage prompt payment. It's to discourage appeal. And I think the provision as it now stands at 10% does those things. Certainly the amendment is preferable to the original bill. So, Mr. Chairman, we would encourage, maintenance of the status quo. We oppose the bill as originally submitted and certainly see the amended bill as being preferable. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Carlson, any comment further?
Mr. Chairman and members, just for edification of the committee, I want you to know that
I think you need to identify yourself for the record, unless you didn't.
Sorry, again, Joel Carlson, again, Mr. Chairman, sorry. Just for the edification of the committee, just want you to know that the 4% rate that Minnesota moved away from in 2009 is the absolute lowest in the country, the lowest. The highest rate that I can find, according to Munich Re, which is a reinsurance agency that publishes
post-judgment interest rates in all 50 states. The business-friendly state of Texas has the highest rate of 18%. Michigan, 13%. There are seven states higher than Minnesota, all in the pro-business category. North Dakota, our friends in Wisconsin, are all higher than us at 12%. Minnesota, when we pegged it at 10%, I just want you to know, that is right in the middle of the pack. There are 12 states that peg it right at 10% as a flat rate. And the flat rate, and I'm happy to work with Representative Mazzarol and others on a floating rate, but just want you to know that the flat rate is also something that is helpful to the courts, because they need to reset that rate and recalculate it, and that takes them time, and they have to recalculate the judgment on it. Now this would be a biannual basis, but the part of the reason that many of the jurisdictions, all of which are over five, and the bulk of which are between 10 and 12, all of them are at a flat rate, because then the courts don't have to go back and recalculate the interest on every year as to what that judgment interest would be. And that's, I mean, it was not a let's just pick 10. I mean, it was done in a deliberative way, and we're happy to talk about the impact on that to the courts, as they now have to go back and recalculate every 2 years what the interest would be on these outstanding judgments. That does have an impact on the court, and that's why many states just use a flat rate, which is what we did in 2009. Happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman, and do appreciate the work on the amendment. I had a chance to speak with you about that earlier, and I do appreciate your efforts in that regard. Thank you.
Mr. Carlson, one question on that. In reviewing some of those, I thought North Dakota was on a floating based off the Wall Street Journal. Is that your understanding as well, or did I get that wrong?
Mr. Chairman and members, North Dakota is set at a interest. I have the document in front of me. It's set at an interest rate of 12%. Although I think there are some, like there are for others, there are variables for how it applies to local units of government or governmental entities. But the information I have in front of me, Mr. Chairman, is that North Dakota, Alabama, Kentucky, Massachusetts, North Dakota, Rhode Island, Vermont, and Wisconsin all have a flat rate of 12%.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question would probably go to the author, but why the threshold of the 50,000, or how was that arrived at?
There's some
Representative
history
Mazzarol
to that.
Or Mr. Carlson?
I believe Mr.
Johnson.
Carlson has the answer to the history to that, and I would defer to his answer.
Mr. Chairman and members, this has been an effort of Chairman Smith, both when he was chairing the Public Safety Committee and afterwards. And the first year that we moved this bill forward in the conference committee, an issue arose that we had not anticipated, and that was by legal aid. And legal aid had a significant concern about the large number of money judgments that were obtained for small amounts, and that the 10% interest rate imposed on top of the contract interest rate, the pre-judgment interest rate on many of those judgments, would just be such a burden that these people would be forced into bankruptcy and would never be able to recover. They did a survey in Hennepin County of judgments in 2007, and while there were a couple of hundred contract and injury judgments that would not few of which even were above the 50,000, there were 13,000 money judgments that were under 50,000, and so it was done not by accident. It was done so that on those smaller money judgments that people did have a chance to recover from a judgment that was obtained against them, and we felt that was a fair compromise.
Any further questions? Is there anybody else in the audience that needs to testify for or against this bill? Mr. Carlson?
I'm good, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, Keith Carlson, I think. Carlson. Sorry.
And the other Carlson.
For the record, please identify the distinction.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association. With me is Gary Carlson with the League of Minnesota Cities. We're here to oppose the bill as it was amended. The state of current law is that the minimum rate, which currently has a 4% floor, that is not always the rate, as I'll go through shortly, applies to judgments for and against local governments. What you have done now with the amendment is for judgments for or against local governments or the state, you've more than doubled the current rate. The current one-year yield on Treasury certificates is running in the neighborhood of a 0.25%, 0.27%. The 8% on top of that raises it to 8.25%, more than double the current 4% rate that applies. As a consequence, both costs for parties against whom we get judgments and costs for us if the judgment is levied against us will more than double. That's a particular concern for us in eminent domain proceedings. Mr. Johnson did a fairly good job of going through the history of this, and frankly, local governments were caught unaware when the first change to the 10% occurred in 2009, and one of my members was surprised when they finally got a judgment in an eminent domain proceedings that they now owe 10% instead of what at the time was the standard 4%. So it is a substantial concern to us. I'll just continue, as was indicated by proponents. We believe that the current situation where it's tied to an indice, the one-year Treasury bill rate, is an appropriate basis. The 8% has no real connection, and I want to make sure that you realize that the 4%, again, is not always the floor. As recently as 2001, the interest rate based solely on the Treasury bill rate was 6%. If this had been in effect in 2001, then the interest rate on judgments for local or state governments or against local or state governments would have been 14%, a substantial amount. Again, I think you're left with the belief that this is never going to go over 10%. In fact, it would be substantially more in times of high interest rates. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Keith Carlson. I understand. Is there Gary Carlson that wants to testify too?
Mr. Chair, members, in the observance of time, really the concerns that the counties
identify yourself have, for the record.
My name is Gary Carlson with the League of Minnesota Cities. In the interest of time, we have the same concerns that Keith just espoused. I do want to clarify that the bill, as introduced, as it came to the committee, we were okay with. We have no problem. It's the amendment that creates the issue for local units of government.
Any further discussion? Having none, the clerk will take the roll. Not a roll call. Having none, the chair will renew Representative Mazarol's motion to pass House File 770 as amended and re-refer it to Judiciary Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign?
No.
Motion prevails.
Division.
Division has been called. All those in favor signify by raising your right hand.
I didn't count very well.
Opposed, same sign.
Yeah, put to it.
Six in favor, four against. My ears are good, Representative Hillstrom. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Mazarol, and I think you can stay there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next to Representative Mazarol, you've sped things up with that. Might even get faster on these, so let's...
I hope so, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mazarol moves House File 951 be recommended to pass and... This also has to go to judiciary and referred to judiciary. Representative Mazerall, you may proceed, and who you have for witness, if you want.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will give a little background, and I have with me two witnesses, two attorneys, Mr. Drew Bays and Mr. Peter Hattinen. Mr. Chair and members, this House File 951 is a technical provision to facilitate a commonly used estate planning technique called a disclaimer. A disclaimer allows a person to disclaim or not accept an inheritance so that it can go to another beneficiary without ownership ever being attributed to the disclaiming person. To be effective, the disclaimant must never have accepted or exercised any beneficial interest in the property that's disclaimed. And this bill clarifies that if a person accepts a trust distribution of only a portion of the trust, the acceptance does not bar a disclaimer of the remaining portion. And in addition to that, there is clarifying language in this bill on the recording of a disclaimer interest in real estate. So I will turn it over, Mr. Chair, to our witnesses.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Peter Hattinen. I'm a lawyer at Frederickson & Byron in Minneapolis. I'm also a member of the State Bar Association's Governing Council of the Probate and Trust Law Section, and I'm co-chair of our legislation committee under the section. Pat did a very good job of summarizing the background of the bill, so I'll dispense with any further background and point you towards sections 5 and 6, which are technical clarifications at the request of the real estate section. They simply clarify that the disclaimer of an interest in real estate is effective upon recording the disclaiming document rather than filing it with the clerk of court. I don't think that's particularly interesting to anybody. It's pretty straightforward. The more important portion of our proposal clarifies that a disclaimer of a partial interest in property, including an interest in a trust, as Pat said, is permissible. Prior law permitted the disclaimer of partial interests, but it's come to our attention that there's a split in the district courts over whether the disclaimer of an interest in a trust is permissible after a beneficiary has accepted a distribution from that trust. Anecdotally, we're aware of several rulings on this issue that support the disclaimer of an interest in a trust after a beneficiary has received the distribution, but we're aware of at least one ruling in Hennepin County to the contrary. So the issue is whether the acceptance of a distribution from a trust bars a beneficiary from disclaiming the balance of the property in a trust, and this comes up relatively frequently if you have a well-off trust beneficiary who just doesn't need those assets anymore and wants to disclaim them in favor of his or her children, for instance. We're also aware of a circumstance where a beneficiary wanted to disclaim an interest in a trust in favor of a local charity. And the statute's very broadly drawn. We've always supported a liberal ability to disclaim property because we want assets allocated efficiently and beneficially. So sections 3 and 4 of our proposal clarify that accepting a distribution from a trust doesn't bar the disclaimer of the balance of that trust property, and then section 4 goes on to clarify that partial disclaimers are permissible, including disclaiming a portion of an interest in a trust. This is clearly tracks state common law, including a Supreme Court case called O'Shaughnessy, which clarifies that a beneficiary may have a beneficial interest in a trust, but that interest doesn't rise to a property interest in a trust, so that a beneficiary does not own everything in the trust. The consequence being that if you accept a distribution of something from a trust, you own that distribution, but you do not own the whole trust. The trustee owns that trust, and you can disclaim the balance of that trust.
Very good. You have one more witness, Representative Mazerall, and I'm not asking.
I believe our other witness is here to answer questions.
Okay.
But doesn't need to testify.
Any questions, members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you explain if this has an impact? My grandmother wants to leave my dad a bunch of money, right? Or she's deceased. She dies and wants to leave money to my dad, but my dad, he's not really, but say he's in a nursing home and getting public benefits. Would this allow him to disclaim that trust, thereby passing all those assets to me, the child, and still be eligible for the state to pay for nursing home benefits and those kinds of things, public assistance?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I believe that would be permissible under existing law, and that would continue to be permissible under our amendment. However, I can't comment on DHS rules regarding eligibility for public assistance. I don't practice in that area, and I don't pretend to know anything about that.
You're not rendering legal advice?
No, I'm not.
Representative Filstrom.
That's it, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mazzarol, or one of the witnesses, you mentioned the recording change from the filing the disclaimer with the clerk of court to now the recorder's office or the registry's office. What's the significance of that, and is that potentially a big change that could trip up some counselors out there?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I believe what the real estate section wanted was clarity on the timing of when a disclaimer is effective. They described, and again, I'm not a real estate lawyer, but they described a lawyer going down to file a document with a clerk of court, and there may be a lag between the time a document's filed and when it's actually been recorded, and they just want it to be clear that the disclaimer of real estate isn't effective until you've actually got something recorded, and therefore the public is on notice that there's been an actual transfer of real estate.
Okay. Any other questions, members? Having no further questions, any other person in the audience here to specifically testify for or against this bill? Having none, the chair will renew Representative Mazzarol's motion to pass House File 951 and re-refer it to Judiciary. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Mazzarol moves House File 952 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Judiciary.
Yes.
Representative Mazzarol, tell us about your second bar bill.
Mr. Chair, members, House File 952 is really a clarifying provision adding the term ward to protected person in the statute governing compensation to guardians and conservators. This also is supported by the Minnesota State Bar Association, and I have with me the same two witnesses regarding this bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Who wants to talk and identify yourself for the record?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again, this is Peter Hattinen from Frederickson and Byron. I'm here representing the Probate and Trust Law section of the State Bar. This is a very simple proposal. It actually reflects a gremlin in that same 2003 Probate Act, I believe. Prior to 2003, guardians could be appointed over the person, or i.e. the ward, or the estate of a person. After the 2003 Act, there was a bifurcation there. Guardians were appointed for wards. Conservators were appointed to oversee a protected person's estate. As when this provision, which addresses the compensation and payment of expenses for people who serve on behalf of guardians and wards, references to wards were dropped in five instances in this statute, even though we have an antecedent referring to guardians and conservators. We only have references to protected persons and not wards. This was brought to our attention by practitioner, and we want to add the reference to wards so that we don't have nonsensical references throughout this statute. We want to foreclose any future questions. I'll stop there unless there are questions. I think this one's absolutely clear.
Any questions, members?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd hate to have nonsensical statutes.
Any
Chair, I was wondering, would this ward be able to vote?
Don't go there.
Representative Mahoney?
Maybe we could talk about the Constitution, too.
That's a good idea, Representative Mahoney. Representative Mazzarol, could we have this? No. Any further questions? Anybody else in the audience want to testify for or against this bill and stand between us tucking our kids in or not? Having no further testimony, no further questions, Representative Mazzarol renews his motion to pass House File 952, be recommended to pass and re-referred to Judiciary. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Members, that concludes our business. Meeting is, well, tomorrow we start at 12:30. I do expect we'll reconvene about 6 o'clock. We'll give you an update in committee, but that's the plan. We do have a room reserved. We've got bills coming to our committee and others that are on the agenda. So with that, meeting is adjourned.